Okay, this is the correct one. So you see that it is 4.3. Point 3 and point 1, because actually the lesson today is quite split. We try to finish the alternative splicing story, and then I will also start the next one, because just to fit everything together. So now what we discussed, can I have your attention please, thank you. What we discussed yesterday was here, so axon intron borders, if remembrance, cis element and transregulatory factors, and we discussed SR and HNRNP factors. Then we started to say, okay, we have probably the necessity to explain some of these more tissue-specific alternative splicing events. We have to put into play some tissue-specific splicing regulators. That is one of the first subject that we discussed today. And then I will discuss some models which try to explain mechanisms of alternative splicing. Okay, so how the machinery can work. So starting from this slide, actually yesterday we have seen these elements, you remember, ESC, ESS, ISC, ISS. The only difference from yesterday yesterday we had two exons and one intron in between, and this time we have an exon in between and two introns aside, but it's not changing actually the idea. And our idea is that essentially we still can call this element ISC, ISS, and blah blah, but we have not only the SR and HNRP proteins, but we also have activator and repressor that are actually different proteins coming into play, and most of them are tissue-specific regulators. Okay, so that's the story. Okay, so the mechanism of alternative splicing has been called in several times by asking for a, this was a kind of older idea, was the explanation that was called the competitive model. What it means? It means that whenever you have a situation like this one, okay, you have a exon and introns, okay, and then you can have these are splicing sites. The blue ones are 3' splicing site, and the red ones are called the 5' splicing site, and these light blue are cis regulatory sequences. Okay. In absence, okay, this model was saying that, okay, whenever you have the absence of other regulatory element, so you don't see any regulatory element here, okay, what is this competition model says that actually the strongest site will win the competition. Okay, so if, for example, if this site here is stronger than this one, and you remember the definition of stronger or weaker yesterday, as this is based on how far the sequence is from the consensus one. Okay, so if it's very similar to the consensus, it's a strong one. If it's slightly non-conserved or with any kind of base changes, becomes weaker and weaker. Okay, so if you have a strong site here and a weak site here, you will always take this kind of pathway, so skipping exon, okay? And vice versa, if a strong side here, a weak side there, so at this point you make the two, okay? So this is the competition model. And actually, it was worked out because people worked essentially in vitro. Okay, so this competitive model came from experiments in which they had this kind of recombinant DNA with exon and introns or whatever, and they put in vitro in the test tube with different components and try to see whether was one or the other one winning. Okay, so this is a kind of, let's say, artificial situation, but it may represent something in vivo as well. I don't know. Okay, So the mechanisms regulating this kind of use is always something like having either an inhibitor. So in the several examples that we will see in the few slides ahead, is that you either have an inhibitor, so a protein that can bind to sites that are close to the splice site and inhibit the SNRNR binding to it. Okay, so this is a simple model of repressing something, okay? Either to have an activator. So you have a, let's say, for example, a weak site here, but you have an activator bound to some intronic splicing enhancer. This is the correct definition. This is intron. So you have intronic splicing enhancer. Then you have an activator that actually will interact with the SNRNR and guiding the SNRNR to read a weak element that SNRNR probably wouldn't do by itself because of low affinity. Okay? So you can have either situation there. Okay? So we have many examples of this. Many. I just found some examples to give to you. Okay? For example, in HIV-1 TAT pre-mRNA, it's just a question of competition between SR proteins and HNRB proteins. Actually, this A1 subtype of HNRP, that is a protein that, as you remember, they are prevalently bound to silencers, okay? Either exonic or intronic silencers. And that's the property to multimerize. So whenever you have a bound protein like this, it will multimerize, making a kind of little chain. And as you can see, this A1 binds to the exonic silencer, but then it multimerizes like this, and it will cover the 3' prime splice site here. Okay, so it doesn't work anymore. The U2AF cannot bind to it. Okay, so it's an inhibitory situation. Okay, but then if you have a high expression of this, this is a SR factor that is called SF2ASF. And if you have a high concentration of this guy here and a low concentration of A1, at this point you have a competition. So this will bind to a ESC that is in this exon, and this will stop polymerization, multimerization of A1. And so in this case, you will allow the 3' prime site to be bound by the normal U2AF. Okay, so it's a normal competition. So this is just regulated apparently by the relative amount of A1 and this SF2-ASF SR protein. Okay, so balance. So this regulation is not based on any additional tissue-specific factor, but just with SR and HNRP protein. Okay. But we have very different models. Okay, for example, I have to show this one. I shouldn't avoid to show this model because it's the one that you find in all the older books of molecular biology. It has been worked something like almost 40 years ago in Drosophila. And this is the cascade of alternative splicing regulation in sex determination in Drosophila. Drosophila, as many other organisms, determine the sex by the X to autosomal chromosomal ratio. Okay, so they have both the females are XX, males are only 1X. Okay, so this is the normal way to determine the sex. Okay, but in Drosophila, okay, there is a another slide. Okay, no problem. There is a product in males, so you have only 1X. There is a autosomal chromosome gene product that is called a DPN. Okay, that will interact with the X chromosome gene product that is called cisA and B, and this product cisA and B interact with this product DPN, and actually it titrates it out, so it forms a complex, and the complex is inactive. Okay, But in female XX, cis AB is double quantity because you have two X's, okay? So the quantity of cis is much higher than the quantity that is expressed for the autosomal gene. So some of the cis is free, and this is a transcription factor, and it bounds to the this PE promoter of the XXL gene. This is early promoter, it's called an early promoter. And this promoter is active in this way, is active only in the individuals that are XX, so in females. Okay? So in this slide, you see everything that happens in the females is in red. Okay? And everything happens in the male is in blue. Okay? So you have transcription of this XXL product. This is actually it's not a transcription factor, it's a splicing factor. So in female you produce a little amount of this XXL, okay, that is composed of this splicing as you can see here. So exon 1 and 4 and 5, 6 and blah blah blah. Okay? And this binds to the other transcript, always from the XXL gene, that is directed by another promoter that is called the major promoter. So you see that it's a little farther, little upstream, okay? And it binds to the exon here in the border from intron to exon 3. And it blocks it, okay? So in female, which expresses this guy here, okay, this is blocked, okay? So in females, you have this splicing here, red. So the exon 2 is spliced to exon 4. And then correctly, all the rest, okay? And this makes a protein, again, the XXL late protein, okay? Good? While in the male, you have this splicing from 2 to 3, and you have a premature termination codon here, UGA. So the protein will be translated with 1, 2, and 3 and stops, and this is a very small protein. It's just a truncated product, no minus, no factor. Okay? So in female, you have high amount of this XXL, and this XXL regulates another gene product that is called a TRAY, that is transformer. The name comes from that, TRA, okay? And again, in female, you have high level of XXL, and this will bind to the border here, in between intron 1 and exon 2. It blocks it. Okay? So if this is blocked, only way is to go to a successive site here, you see? So in female, you use 1 to half exon 2, that is in frame, so then you have 2 to 3, and you make a correct factor TRA. Okay? In the male individual, you don't have the block, so you splice 1 to 2, and again you have a stop codon there. So truncated product, no action. Okay, minus. Then finally, the last regulatory story is that this TRA factor is again a splicing factor. But this time is a positive one, it's not a repressor. This was a repressor, okay? Repressor of the splicing. This is a positive factor. So this TRA will bind to a ESC, so to a exonic splicing enhancer, that is placed here in exon 4 of this guy. This is a gene, DSX means double sex. Okay, because the mutant Drosophila had double sex characters and so on. Okay, so this is binding to here and induces, in this case, the splicing proximal. So in female, you have 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4. Okay, this makes a protein that is this DS6F as a female, that is a transcription factor that will inhibit all the male genes, so all the genes that are involved in development of male characters, okay, inhibitory, okay. This time also the other splicing, so you don't have TRA in males, the males, so you cannot include exon 4, so you skip it, and exon 3 is spliced to exon 5, but it's normal this time, so you have a frame, no problem. You go ahead and you make a male transcription factor, that is DXM, and this will inhibit female linked genes. So you have a cascade of positive and negative regulatory events on the splicing, okay, that illustrates to you an example of how these factors can work. So this is the sexlethal. I told you already, so this sexlethal binds to here, to the polypyrimidine tract, okay, and so it will direct the UAF on the second cryptic site in the middle of the exon. But if you don't have this kind of protein here, the U2AF will bind to the first splicing site. Okay, it's a normal story. Okay, so another example, this is, we are going out from the Drosophila story. There is another example of positive regulation. Okay, whenever you have this weak site, this is the Fox ligand gene and the RNA. Okay, and so this usually doesn't recognize this splice site, but here in the intron you have an intronic splicing enhancer that binds this protein here. This guy is TIA1. This is a positive splicing factor, and this will protein-protein interact with U1, putting it on the correct splice site. Okay, so there are many. I can continue to tell you about many, many other different examples, but I think that the story is clear to you. Okay, so the list is very long, and looking for tissue-specific alternative splicing factor, there are many of those. This is a quite old review that I took, because today we know enormous list, so just tell about some of them. And just to make your attention to some of them, this, for example, this NPTB, you remember maybe from yesterday that we presented already, this PTB is polypyrimidine tract binding protein. Okay, there is one version, one homologous of this PTB that is ubiquitary, so it's present in all the cells. There is one special one that is called NPTB that is typically expressed only in neurons, so only in the neuronal cells. Okay, and so this will direct special splicing, you will see in a moment. It binds to the cuckoo cuckoo, because it's easy to remember. the sequence, and then the other protein that you have to remember is this NOVA1, NOVA2. They are again neuron specific tissue splicing factor, and they, as you can see, they recognize a quite degenerate sequence, this pyrimidine CA pyrimidine, so it's not really very tightly determined, okay, and NOVA2 is more or less the same. And then we have many other, like this one, for example, this also very important, that is ESRP1, ESRP12, that are typical of epithelial cells. And for example, in this case, it's very interesting because people have demonstrated that if you take a mesenchymal cell and then you transfect with a vector expressing ESPR1 and ESPR2, and they will make a reverse transition, a mesenchymal to epithelial transition. So it is sufficient to have regulation of splices to change phenotypes in cells. The same you can obtain if you take epithelial cells and then you make knockdown of the expression of these two guys, and the cell starts becoming a mesenchymal one. That's quite important as a story. Okay, then these are others. Don't make me describing all of them, but just to see that there are many, many, many examples in in the literature, and as I told you, this is 10 years ago, so today we have several slides of at least different transcription, splicing factor. This is a huge category. Actually, it is increasing because people started to make experiments of binding to RNA and so on. So, just to tell you, in 2005, we knew something like maybe 30 splicing factor. Today, we have at least protein of RNA binding protein is close to 700. So, it's kind of story. Not all of them are known. I mean, the function are not known. But anyway, it's an important piece of work, anyway. Okay. So, we were talking about PTB and NPTB, and this is linked, for example, to the inclusion of the famous alternative exon of the SARC gene. You remember SRC, what it is? It's a tyrosine kinase transducer. Okay, there is one small exon that is called N1 that is only spliced in neurons. Okay, so it's absolutely specific. And this is just because in normal cell, in non-neuronal cells, you have expression of this PTB. This PTB makes a kind of cross story in the intron, and actually this will mask completely this N1 exon. So in non-neuronal cells, this binding of PTB here in two places, here and here in the intron, will make this exon skipping. Okay? In neurons, on the contrary, you don't have this PTB, you have NPTB. And NPTB makes another story, so it binds to this element, the same that you see before, but not to the other one. And so, making this, it actually leaves free this other part of the intron, and this will be bound by the normal factors. So, in cooperation with other proteins, of course, but this is makes the exon be included. Okay, so this is the story. And also, I want you to show you some results on the NOVA. NOVA was worked out by Robert Danner group that is very famous in this field. And they had a list of regulated messenger RNA. So RNA that were previously found to be regulated by NOVA1 and NOVA2 by microRNA expression, substantially. So they made kind of experiments like this, okay? And then they made a novel technology that was developing in those years, that was the CLIP. CLIP means cross-link immunoprecipitation. It's very similar to what you do with DNA, like chip, but the difference is that for RNA, you don't need to make formaldehyde to cross them. You just make a flash of UV light, and this will cross covalently the RNA to protein. Okay, covalent bound. Okay, so they crossed the by UV, and then they added an antibody against NOVA1 and NOVA2. Okay, so they immunoprecipitated only the RNA that are bound by NOVA. Okay, so at this point, of course, these binding sites were identified by microarrays. At that time, NGS was not yet available, so they identified the bound RNA by microarray analysis. And that after that, they explored the sequences of those RNA for finding the cluster of this sequence, YCAY, that is the sequence recognized by the factors. Okay. And what they found is that is a strange story, is that they could map overall the presence of this NOVA protein in an example, intron exon, and this is the skipped exon in between. This is a model, of course, but this has been taken from the sum of all the other events that they could recognize. And as you can see, there is many these kind of peaks that you see here, like this one and this one and this one and this one, are all the places that on average, so on all the 48 regulated messenger RNA, usually carry a binding site for a NOVA. Okay? But with an important difference. Whenever you have these sites that are marked in pink or red, I don't know, probably was originally a red, okay, you have enhancing effect on the inclusion of the exon. Okay, so if NOVA binds here, or binds here, or binds here, and, or here, the effect is including the exon inside. Okay, whenever you are binding in the blue regions, like this one, all over the exon, okay, you have the opposite effect. So you have exclusion of the exon. That's an important notion. It actually tells us that the factor itself is not the property of being activator or repressor. And that complicates the story much, a lot actually. It means that this the position dependent. So depending on the place in which it binds, it can have activatory effect or repressive effect. Okay. This actually was the first paper of a series. They made this in 2006, and then when the NGS appeared, they repeated the experiment several times. The number of genes regulated is a little higher than this one, and also they could map the story. But this holds true, so it is like this, okay? And they show you some PCR. Yeah?
What is different? What is
in italiano.
Sì. Perché qual è il motivo per cui si lega nei pezzi blu o nei pezzi rossi?
Perché? Qual è la differenza? In some messenger RNA you have the site there, in other messenger RNA you have a site in another place. This is an average. Sorry, this is an average of all the 48 genes that they found regulated by NOVA. Okay, average. The sum of them, okay? So in some of those messengers you have a site here, or a site here, or a site here. But whenever you have the site in the red places, you have activator. Whenever you have the site in the blue ones, you have the repressor, okay? And they show you some examples. This is a PCR, normal PCR. How you can do a simple, this is also some teaching important for you, that are quite young in the field. So how you can determine splicing? You can take a primer here and a primer here and make PCR. Okay, not quantitative real-time PCR, but normal endpoint PCR. Then you run the product on a gel and measure the size. Okay, so this figure means that you have both the splicing form inclusion, that is higher molecular weight, or exclusion, that is lower molecular weight. Can you follow me? And here, as you can see, you have less inclusion, okay, than in the other one. So what they did was to take a mouse that was carrying the double KO of the two factors. Okay, so in those mice, no NOVA expression, so no regulation. In other words, okay? So they, in this double KO, they examine some of the genes that are regulated. And as you can see, there are cases in which the effect is positive, because when you knock down, you have a reduction of the inclusion, okay? And the binding site is there in the intron. Reduction of the inclusion. This is the binding site in this case. Reduction of the inclusion. This is really zero inclusion, okay? And this guy here, again, this is a kind of 3' alternative. And again, if you knock out there, okay, no inclusion. Okay. On the contrary, you have example in which the effect is the other way around. Look at this. You have a site here in this gene. Okay, and this makes the story. So in wild type, you have no inclusion. Okay, when in KO, you have inclusion. Same story here, okay? So it's quite clear in the effect system. Okay? So this, is, on the contrary, is the this ESRP1, ESRP2 that I told you, there are epithelial-specific genes, okay? So they are expressed only in epithelial cells. And this is an important regulation, again, very important, because they actually help, they regulate a splicing in the this FGFR2 gene. This is, FGF is fibroblast growth factor. If you remember what it is? Yeah. And this R stands for receptor, and this 2 just because there are 2. Okay, so these are FGF receptor 2. That is a long messenger RNA with many exons and introns. The figure doesn't show you all the messenger RNA because it's too long. It just concentrates on exon 7, exon 9. And in between exon 7 and exon 9 are two exons that, as the figure suggests, are mutually exclusive. So if you mount, if you splice in the 3B, it's called a 3B, don't ask me why, I don't know. This, I probably call it 8.1 and 9.2, but anyway, they call it 3B and 3C. Okay? So if you include, if you splice in 3B, you don't splice 3C and vice versa. Okay, so you have two versions of this messenger RNA, one in epithelial cells and the other one in mesenchymal cells. The first carries this exon, epithelial isoform, and the other one carries this, the mesenchymal isoform with 3C. Okay, good. So in the this is the receptor, transmembrane plates. These are TK, the tyrosine kinase domains in the intracytoplasmatic, okay? And these are the three IgG-like domains in the exterior that actually make the ligand binding domain, okay? So the region that is spliced differentially is this one, half of the IG3, so the three motif. And this makes an enormous biological difference, because in epithelial isoform, this receptor that include the 3B will receive the not the fibroblast growth factor signal. So it doesn't bind fibroblast growth factor, but it will bind keratinocyte growth factor. So another factor that is typical of epithelia, of course. Okay? Then when you have this one inside, you have the receptor for fibroblast growth factor, which is typical of mesenchymal cells and not by keratinocytes. So a small difference in one single small exon makes two different proteins that are tissue specifically regulated. Okay, so how it works? Again, it's a little complicated, but don't be scared. Okay, the 3B is there. Okay, and the 3C is there. So when you are in mesenchymal cells, you have this PTB that you know already. Okay, so you have three ISS. ISS, okay, that actually inhibit the inclusion of this, okay? And conversely, you have a X, that means a not yet identified factor that binds to this intronic splice enhancers that will sustain inclusion of this 3C. On the contrary, when you have it in epithelial cells, okay, the story is just try to make the color in place. Okay, so you have this kind of exon that is bound by this TIA on intronic splicing enhancer. It makes it included, okay, plus. And there are cooperation with many other factors, positive factors that are bound to different enhancers here in the intron. Okay, on the contrary, you have this, in this IESC, ISS3, you have binding of this factor that actually will stop inclusion of this 3C. Okay, so you have composition of factor, but in between them you have SPR, that this is completely specific. Okay, good. So these are examples, okay, just to tell you that is the, in the real life what I am telling you is true. Usually it's the contrary. You make experiments and then derive a theory, but okay. And then what I want to go through now is this kind of kinetic competition model, because I presented to you the first competition model and we started to look at different kind of examples. But in the real reality, as you know, yesterday we discussed the fact that the splicing is co-transcriptional. Okay, so talking about competition model, whenever you have actually that the sites are not contemporaneously present in the messenger RNA, because they emerge in different times. So it changes a little bit, okay? So you have that this is our friend polymerase that is going through a gene, and so the first part of the RNA has been transcribed, this is the cap, this is exon 1, and this is SR protein that, as usual, bind to the exon 1. Then here you have a border, so you have exon intron border, okay? And so, as usual, you have U1 that will bind to it, okay? Because this is the 5' splice site, so the U1 will bind to it, and here you have HNNRPS protein binding to the intron, as usual, and then the polymerase moves on, and so this is exactly the same, but also continue transcribing, you have the emergence of the other border. So the intron stops here, you have the second exon coming out, okay? So this border will be bound by U2AF, as you know, and the branching point will be bound by this BDP, okay? So this is determined from here to here. You have already the intron defined, right, by the proteins. So at this point, theoretically, you have everything is needed to join the U2 here and to bound the splices. Maybe. Okay, then let's move the polymerase a little further again. So the polymerase moves on, and at this point you have another possible splice site here. So this is a case in which you have a alternative 3', okay? So you have a border here, good border, then you have another border here. So what is the decision? What I'm trying to communicate to you is this immediate? I mean, coming back to a step, is this immediate or this takes time? If this takes time, now you have the competition model. But otherwise you don't. Okay? I mean, if the splicing works here, no competition with any site. It's done. So, what I am meaning is that in the competition model that we discussed, we have to put the time inside. If we don't put the time, we cannot understand really what happens. Okay? So, to make alternative splicing here, we need that this action takes a time. Okay, then you have the second splice site to come, and then if this is better than this one, stronger than this one, probably you have the other one. Good, so this is the, at this point you have two models, okay? One possible model is the first arrived, first served. I mean, the splice that arrives first is served, and again. And this can be compatible with one observation. I mean, if you imagine that everything takes a lot of time, so the polymers go through and then transcribes other introns, other exons, and blah, 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 then you cannot justify why most of the time the splicing is correct. Because there is no reason why exon 1 cannot be spliced to exon 7. Why? There is no particular reason. RNA is not rigid. It's not like a rigid that we always depict. It's a flexible molecule. There is no reason to this. So probably there is a strong component saying that, okay, the first arrival, first service works in many cases. Okay, not all of them. Otherwise, you cannot explain alternative splice. Okay. So starting from this kind of consideration, the people try to start to think about the speed of polymerase. Because of course, if you have a polymerase that goes very slow, you can have more occasion to mount the U1, okay, so or U2. I mean, you can put the splicing factors with sometimes. While if the polymers go very fast, if you have weak site, probably they cannot be served by the different factors. Okay? So there are two observations. The first is that the speed of RNA polymerase actually is variable and discontinuous. Okay? And this can probably depend on the elongation factors that are charged on the RNA pole by different promoters and enhancers. So you have a kind of variable speed of the polymerase. This is the first data. The second is that actually several studies that have been made essentially with co-immunoprecipitation or also immunolocalization, they show that the CTD of the RNA polymerase 2 is like a truck that it binds to many of the splicing factors. So the splicing factors like SR protein, HNRP protein, they are found to interact with the CTD of the polymerase. So in some sense you can imagine this polymerase like a truck that carries all the factors that are needed to load it. Okay, so of course if the polymerase is low, you have many occasions to charge the factors on the RNA, on the molecule of RNA. Okay, so this is the two reasons. So the main actor of this kind of story about the speed was exactly this Alberto Corbly that has written the review that you have as a textbook. And he actually, very, very many years ago, as you can see, this is 2002, published a very famous study on the speed of the polymerase and trying to understand if the speed of the polymerase can justify different splicing events. What he did was to construct a reporter gene. So he constructed a promoter system here with putting an artificial gene, and in this intron he cloned this alternative exon from the fibronectin gene. This is a famous alternative exon. This is a weak exon that is included only sometimes in the transcript. Okay. And then he put some of these enhancers upstream of the promoter, just to regulate the efficiency of the promoter. Okay. Now, what you do is exactly this one. So, whenever you have, a slow promoter, this is the fibronectin promoter here, you can see some inclusion in the message. Okay, so this exon, the primers are there, so you measure the expression by primer here. So if you have a higher molecular weight band, it means that you have included this guy. Okay. So you see that if I put the promoter of fibronectin, okay, that is apparently a slower promoter, you have inclusion of this EDI exon. If you put another stronger promoter, this coming from the alpha globin, you have exclusion. So apparently, depending on the strength of the promoter, you have exclusion or inclusion. There is an effect of it. And actually, at this point, he measured different promoters element. This is an enhancer. So placing an enhancer again, it made all the stories. Don't make me going through all the experiments, but the story is, the message is, whenever you have a strong promoter, you have exclusion. Whenever you have a weaker promoter, you have inclusion. So it means that in some way, it seems that the strength is important. So at this point, he asked himself, but is real this trend that I see? Is real the fact that I can have more or less polymerase on the story? So he measured the density of the polymerase on the message. How to measure the density of the polymerase on the message? You can make cheap sick. Okay, so this is not a RNA protein interaction, is a DNA protein interaction. Okay, so this is the gene, actually is the artificial gene, is the reporter one. Okay, this is the reporter, and you make chip analysis of RNA polymerase. Okay, so you can, using different primers, couples, you can measure the density in this region, the density in this region, the density in this region. And what it clearly showed is that whenever you have, for example, a very strong promoter, okay, you have a density of the polymerase on that site here, the U site, that is just before the exon, okay. The density here is very low as compared to a weak promoter. You see here, this is fibronectin promoter. So slow polymerase, and this is something like three times the density that you have in the other case. What it means? It means that whenever you have a, let's say, less processive polymerase, okay, you go through the gene, and then the polymerase is stalled before the exon that has to be spliced in. Okay? So this gives you occasion, as I told you, to put splicing factor on the exon. Whenever you have a fast tracking polymerase, the density is lower and probably there is no occasion to include a weak exon. So this was the original theory. Okay, this is just what I told you before. And this was called the speed bump model. In the other sense, the reasoning was that, okay, why the polymerase will start there instead of going through? Maybe that this exon is tight. This exon cannot be passed easily, okay, by the polymerase. And why a polymerase could be stuck before an exon, in your mind? What can be one of the possible mechanisms? Please.
Maybe there are many GC components when you have open babies.
This can be a reason, another one, another choice. If you have a region on a gene in which the polymerase stops, what can you think about? Another mechanism. The GE content is a good way. Any other mechanism?
Nucleosomes.
Yeah, nucleosomes. Nucleosomes is another story. You can also have some structure of the RNA, as you know, the pose of the terminating sequences are looped sequences. You may have different mechanisms. So anyway, the reasoning was actually most of the reasoning at that time was about the presence of a nucleosome over there. Okay, so the scientists decided that this was the most likely hypothesis for this relenting the polymerase, so difficulty to remove a nucleosome. And this was a theory until actually we made. Do you have to stop? No, I can go. Actually, it was a good theory until the time in which we could measure the positioning of nucleosomes. Do you remember how it is made? Do you remember how to measure the position of nucleosomes?
DNA.
Yeah, kind of special DNAs. You remember the name? Micrococcal, remember this micrococcal digestion, okay? So we talked about already several times. So you take the chromatin, right? Actually, the micrococcal is made in wall nuclei, but anyway, you treat with micrococcal nuclei. This is, a double action DNAs because it cuts the linker and then it trims exo. It trims until it reaches the nucleosome. So, as a result, you get only the DNA that is around the nucleosome. So, if you have a positioned nucleosome, so the nucleosome that stays in that sequence in all the alleles that you study. Okay, you have a high signal of that sequence. On the contrary, if this nucleosome slides casually random, you have a low signal. Okay, that's the reason. So people did exactly this. This is a famous paper that was coming out in 2009, and these are the same names, if you remember, of the ENCODE guys that made all the story. And so they measured the nucleosome positioning in several lines, especially in a line in which they could make activation and not... in which they had already the data from active genes and inactive genes. Okay. So let's see the results now. So they discovered first one important story. That is that they found, and this is the reason why this paper was actually a famous paper, a strong paper, because they found that the nucleosomes like to sit over the exons. Okay? So the nucleosomes, all the genome around, they like to be set on exons. So if you measure the occupancy of all exons in the genome, and on the contrary you have these sides that are intronic, of course, right and left, you find a good peak that this is the black line is the all 76,000 exons they measured, which is a lot, and they have this good signal here, this black line. Okay, so in other words, it means the nucleosomes are of course on the introns but not positioned, so they go away casual, random, okay? But on the exons, they are fixed there. Okay. Now, look for this. They made another very interesting observation because they had information. Don't look at the violet one that is confounding. Just look at these two categories, the blue one and the red one. They had information at that time on alternative splicing about 3,800 weak exon, that means exons that are alternative, okay? So they chose the same number of strong exons, or constitutive exons, out of the 76,000 to have a control, negative control. And look at the distribution. So if you look at the strong exons, that is the red line here, you have a peak, that is here, okay? But when you look at the blue ones, so the weak alternative exons, you have even higher signal. So in other words, it appears that the weak exons are much more bound to nucleosomes than the other ones. Okay? Does, and now the question, does it fit with the theory of the bump model? Go back, 1, 2, 3. Does it fit with this model? Alternative exons are more occupied by a nucleosome than constitutive ones. Do this fit with this? I see many heads shaking like this. Yes, it fits. Means that whenever you have an alternative exon, you have more effect of relenting, okay, as shown in the other slide. And so this makes that all the splicing factors that are there have more occasion to go to the sites, to bind to there. Okay? So inclusion. Okay? So this is the... Sorry. This is the story. Okay? So this... okay, then you can examine in between the non-transcribed genes and transcribed genes, and they made a lot of other subcategories, but in any case, you see that on the weak exon you have always a very good position in nucleosomes. Good for the moment. So now it's just nucleosome, but anybody knows... can you resist for additional 5 minutes? Yeah? No? Yeah. Okay. So we know that the nucleosomes are not nucleosomes, they are also, of course, the PPMs, whether it's a methylation, acetylation, whatever. So you can also ask for that. Okay, so in this paper they measured actually the other stories. And so what they did was just to make a lot of cheap seq analysis and then to match with the nucleosome positioning. Okay. And then to make a ratio, so exon over intron. So how much of any of these modifications I found in exons versus what I found in introns. Okay? So you have an equal line, that is one here. So if you are there, means no difference in between exons and introns. Okay? If you are over, means that you have more in exon. If you are less in exons. Okay? So now, of course, since the nucleosomes are more positioned in the exons, most of the values are over. Of course, you see more than that. Okay? Then you can also calculate the probability that is significant, because of course you have little difference. Maybe it is not significant. Okay? But as you can see, many of those as two stars. That means that they are significant. Okay? And look at the major regulators of them. You see that, for example, this 36Me3, that as you remember is the modification that you always find only in the body of the genes, sorry, only in the transcribed part, okay, is much higher in exon than in introns. Okay? So this is another story. You also find another modification, that is the K9, if I remember well. No, not the K9. There is this one, the K27Me3. Okay, so these are modifications that are bound, apparently distributed on exons more than in introns. So these are the graphs, and this is the K27Me3. So apparently not only there is position, but also there are special chromatin marks on those. Why, in your opinion, then we stop for a minute, also to make your teacher resting a bit. But what I mean is that, what, in your opinion, can be the significance of having particular PTMs mark on the spliced exons? I mean, a part of the stability of the exon itself, okay. But can this have another function, in your opinion? This is called epigenetic, right? I'm trying to suggest to you. Epigenetic, what it means? A character that is mitotically inherited. So this means that the cell that has decided to splice one exon, okay, because it's epithelial, mesenchymal, or whatever, also keep a mark, say, okay, this is a H3, K37Me3 over this exon, and we replicate in the daughter cells. So they don't have to make again all the story putting factors in factors, because they have a mark. Okay, this is an alternative exon, I will tell it like this. Nice to know. Okay, so this is, you can skip it, just a weak and strong and whatever. Okay? Good, so we are on time. Can we stop for a kind of thing? Okay, so the second part of the lesson 4.3 is actually something that is in between for my last lesson, that is Monday, and it's just talk about this post-transcriptional regulation. We just ask what happens to this messenger RNA once it's made. Okay, so we discussed all these kind of stories. Of course, you know that these are called transcriptional, capping, exon, splicing, polyadenylation, whatever. So now, finally, following the theory, finally this RNA detaches from the chromatin, as you remember yesterday, and we have additional phenomena. So we have a lot of things before going to final to the end of the life of RNA that are different stories. I don't want to treat all of them in a very deep way because it's too much, but just to either remember to you for people that knows the subject, or just to make a, let's say, information very, very, very superficial, but anyway. So we have to talk about editing and methylation, transport to the cytoplasm, quality control, localization to cellular compartments, and regulated translation, regulated degradation, RNA interference. These four subjects we will develop on Monday. Just try to make these three that are quick for today. So, of course, we have additional chemical modification that happens to the, especially to messenger RNA, but nobody knows on the other types. Nobody studied, for example, on long non-coding RNAs. And as you can see, there are many methylations. Methyladenation to adenine in position 6, to in position 1. Then methylcytosine, of course, as in the DNA. And then also there are some modification a little more deep, like pseudouridine transformation of the uridine. This is the most abundant transformation that mostly in RNA, ribosome RNA and tRNA, as you know, but also in to several messenger RNAs. And also methylation to the 2' OH of the ribose, that is typical, for example, at the very beginning of the RNA. Okay, so the first two or three nucleotides gets methylated in those ribosome positions. What is the meaning? The meaning is subject of debate, because actually nobody really knows what they are. But the story today that is very modern and many groups are trying to work it out is the RNA adenine methylation. That is actually several enzymes have been characterized to carry on this kind of methylation here. And also enzymes that actually are erasers, so they go back to the normal adenosine on the messages. And also there are some proteins that behave like readers, so they are capable of binding to methylated adenine and not to unmethylated adenine. Okay. So what is the story? Okay, first of all, the people could actually work out this consensus. That means the adenine should be preceded by two purines and then followed by a C and H. As you remember, H is non-G base. Then the story is very different and very various, when actually no real conclusion has been made. One of the stories is that the methylation to position 6 of adenine actually doesn't change what's in Greek pairing. Okay, so the pairing of the adenine to a uracil doesn't change, okay, as a test. But the problem is that this pairing is weaker than the normal. So you have a weakened interaction. And in at least some cases, this has been shown to change the secondary structure of the RNA. So a structure like this finger that you see here, so this loop, is actually weakened by methylation. So you have methylation, you can actually probably disrupt the secondary structure. And in some cases has been shown, for example, this HNMNPC, that is one of these proteins that bind the RNA, and as you can see, it cannot bind if the sequence is non-methylated, while if you get methylation here, then the UUUU sequence is free to be bound by this protein. So this is one of the cases in which you have. And then there exist other cases in which when you have methylation, you can bind some proteins, specific protein to it, and this will probably join as pricing factor and whatever. So it means that you have a regulation like this one. Okay. Then you also have different kind of stories, because there are different proteins like this one and this one that have been found to interact with methyl adenine on the RNA, but with different effects, in that if you bind this one, you have positive effect on translation. These are the, probably you remember, this is the initiation factor for translation, okay? And on the contrary, if you have binding of this protein, you have opposite action. You associate this KNOT1 protein that actually means degradation. So it will associate it to the exosome and degrade. So you have opposite effect with the same methylation depending on the kind of breeding protein that is expressed in the cell. Then in general, just to make a general story of the methylation, it seems like methylation of adenine accelerates all the metabolisms. Okay? So you have that the processing accelerate, translation accelerate, and also the decay accelerate, as compared to the unmethylated form of an RNA. So if you look at the lifetime of the messenger RNA, in unmethylated form is slower as an action, okay? And then it probably lasts longer, and so then it disappears. When you have methylation, you have very quick action, so put in place, and then you have also very quick degradation. So this is the general effect of methylation. So the methylation to adenine can change in some way the life, okay? The life of a messenger RNA. But people are still working on it. We don't know the determinants why some RNA gets methylated and another one doesn't. It's really completely to understand, to work out, okay? Good. This is a not interesting story, because it's the, I told you, this life that is extended or shortened. So if you, for example, you make this methyl 3, is the one of the enzymes here that makes the methylation, okay? So people, for example, have tried to knock it out. So you make a knockout mouse that has no methyl 3, so it cannot methylate. And as you can see, with no methylation, there is no, this is the naive state, and this is the primary state, and you have a very slow development of the ESLs, okay? While whenever you have methylation, you go through the normal time of development of these ESLs. So this is the transition from naive to prime. So you remember the very first steps to determine the fate of the ESLs. Okay, now if you want to know more, there is a review here, 2017, you can read. But I don't go through all the story because it's a little too complicated for me. Then, the other story that can happen just to say that this methylation happens in the nuclear spicules. You remember the bodies that you see in the nuclei, okay? So it's a nuclear event, okay? Then another story that is a modification of the sequence itself is this editing. Have you ever heard about editing of RNA? Neurobiologists should know. Who are you is making the neurobiological curriculum? 1, 2, 3? You don't know about editing? No, just because the most famous example is this glutamine receptor. The gene encoding for glutamine receptor 2 has a special change. Editing means that you take one base and you convert to another one after transcription. Okay? So this the enzyme that makes this kind of change is called ADAR, adenosine deaminase. Okay? And this converts adenosine to inosine. Inosine actually stays there, but the problem is that inosine behaves like a G when you make pairing, okay? So it's no longer an A, as a matter of fact, that is a G, either for translation or in secondary structures. Okay? So people realize that this phenomenon happened because you find another amino acid instead of the one that you thought from the gene. Okay? So that's apparently this doesn't concern many genes, fortunately. Not many genes and not in many positions get edited. So this is a chance for us, because otherwise, whenever you make RNA sequencing, you find different sequences from the DNA, it will be embarrassing. So few cases of editing. But anyway, you have to know that this happens. Okay, now let's go to the transfer to cytoplasm. Okay, now we have got this messenger RNA or whatever RNA that is done, and the only story that I have to tell you about is that this is not RNA. In the books usually you say RNA, messenger RNA, and this is not messenger RNA, exactly as the DNA is not DNA but is chromatin. Okay, this is never naked RNA. Never find naked RNA in the real life, okay? You always find RNA in association with many different proteins, okay? So this is called mRNP, so messenger ribonuclear protein. This is important as a concept because many of these proteins that are bound to the messenger RNA co-transcriptionally, so in some way they will depend on the transcription process, in some way. Also from the, you remember this dependency on the promoter kind, enhancer kind, or whatever, okay? So you may have different proteins bound to the particle. This will be actually transported to the cytoplasm together with the messenger RNA. Okay, I make you a practical example. There is one of these hnRNP proteins, if I remember well, is the A2 subtype, that binds to the messenger RNA. It goes to the cytoplasm, and then it has been shown to drive the cytoplasmatic localization of the messenger RNA. Okay, so for example. Again, neurobiologists should know that there are many messenger RNA that are only present for example, in axons or in dendrites. Okay, so they are not diffused away. But not only for neurons. For example, in normal epithelial cells, the acting encoding messenger RNA is only in the apical part of the supranuclear apical part of the cell, is never in the basal part. So this means that there are active mechanisms to localize them. Okay, and this depends on the protein that actually are loaded on the messenger RNA during transcription. So during the preparation of the messenger RNA. Okay, so that's important as a concept. Okay. Good. So important story is also this exon junction complex. During the second step of splicing, so when you have the second transesterification, okay, there are proteins that are called the exon junction complex that are loaded something like 20 to 24 nucleotides from the 5' end upstream of the splice junction. They stay there, okay? So there is the exon, so just 25 nucleotides before you have a protein that sits down. Over there. This is called an exon junction complex, and this is extremely important because it will drive a quality control mechanism that is called NMD, nonsense mediated decay. Okay, whenever you have a pre-termination codon, like in the case you remember of alternative splicing, which you have pre-termination codon somewhere, this will drive the RNA to degradation through this mechanism. And this is dependent on this exon junction complex. Okay. So the other story that I have to say to you is that the transport to the cytoplasm is actually specific. Again, you have many proteins that take care of each particular kind of different RNA. So you have messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, small nuclear RNA, miRNA, and tRNA, and each of them has specific proteins binding to it that take care of the transfer to the cytoplasm. Why we should know this apparently tricky story? Because each of this transportation, since it depends on a particular protein, is saturable. Okay, so if you have a number of exporting 5, for example, taking care of the miRNA, they are saturable. If you express a transgene encoding a miRNA, as we do several times in the lab, it will saturate the transport. So you cannot pass over a certain degree of transfection just because you don't have any more protein transporting it to the cytoplasm. Okay, so this something that probably many people do not think about. This is so miRNA cannot be transported by other proteins, only by this specific transporter here. Okay. So good. And what else? So this is the nucleus, and this is the cytoplasm. And as you can see from this complex slide, there are many other things that we have to take care about. So this mRNA particle goes to the cytoplasm, and as I told you, some of the proteins that are connected, this is the AJC complex, for example, stays bound in the cytoplasm. But in part, these proteins are what they call remodeled. So some proteins go away, and is replaced by other proteins that are in the cytoplasm. Okay? The nuclear proteins that are bound and that are dissociated from the messenger RNA are usually recycled back to the nucleus. So here you see, for example, that there is this cytoplasmatic quality control, the K, so the mechanism that I told you, whenever there is a pre-termination signal, the messenger RNA is just eliminated as soon as it is in the cytoplasm. We have another mechanism that is called nuclear quality control decay, also here, that takes care of particular problems in the RNA. Okay. And then this messenger RNA can go to different destiny. The first one is to go to translation, of course. This is common, okay, but it's not the only one. You can localize, as I told you. You can degrade the messenger RNA, because you have this pathway that is actually the microRNA pathway. You remember this name, probably RISC. Okay, so it binds, microRNA binds to there, then it's guided to a target, and this will be degraded, okay? Or blocked. Some of the messenger RNA are not degraded, but they are just blocked in these P bodies that are called also stress granules, in which the messenger RNA can stay for a while, then it can go back to the translation or to decay, different pathways, okay? So many things happens, okay? So this is the remodeling, so some of the proteins are remodeled, okay? And this is the quality control I told you, okay? The quality control, quality control, there are essentially three types of quality control. This is the nonsense mediated decay that is probably the most abundant as a mechanism. And this means that whenever you have a pre-termination code, okay, this is the normal messenger RNA, this is the normal termination codon. If you get a pre-termination codon here, this messenger RNA is guided to the degradation. Why? There are mechanisms described. I don't want to annoy you about it. But anyway, it probably depends on the fact that the AJC, I remember AJC, exon junction complex, they should sit here somewhere, because if you have a pre-termination codon, probably you still have an exon-exon junction somewhere. So some scientists think that this mechanism depends on the presence of an AJC complex here, somewhere, okay? But actually other mechanisms have been described. So the take-home message is that you have nonsense-mediated decay of premature termination, codon-containing RNA. Then there is another mechanism that is called non-stop decay, in the sense that if for any reason there is no longer this TC, so the termination codon, for mutation or whatever, okay, so you don't have the termination codon, the RNA polymerase, ribosome will go through it and continue the synthesis of protein. And in this case, you have a mechanism of getting rid of this messenger RNA that is called this non-stop decay. Nobody knows exactly the mechanism of this, you know? And then there is this non-go decay mechanism, that is whenever you have something that happens here that avoids the ribosome to go through, like a secondary structure or a protein that cannot move from there or something, you have a mechanism that is called no-go decay. Okay. So you have different quality controls in the cell. Probably the most important is this one, NMD, also because it's the most frequent. This is quite rare, and this also. This is quite common, especially because you remember that there are many splicing events, differential splicing events, that actually bring a stop codon in the message. Okay? So probably this works quite often like this, okay? And this, there are many authors, many scientists that think that this is a real method, a way, pathway to dampen the expression of that messenger. So whenever you cannot do repression by normal transcriptional repression, you can have a splicing event that brings in a pretermination code, and then all the message will be put away, and the expression of the protein will be repressed. Okay, I don't know if it's real or not, but anyway, this is it. So, okay. So I think that we are done for today, and in Monday we will discuss regulation of RNA stability and decay, and of course the main subject will be RNA interference and microRNAs. Okay. So you have a review that is also the last one for the part. That is from David Bartel, that is one probably the most important scientist in the field, that I suggest you just to read at least the first parts that describing the mechanism of microRNA working, okay? So you can go through the lesson quite easily if you read it in advance. I don't put any other exercise, so any other activity, so you have time to read it. And please, I just talked before with the other guys here, you have to find additional 2 hours in May, you remember, for your reports.